Hello and welcome to everyone who's watching and listening online, and to everyone gathered in this place. Today we are continuing our series from Ecclesiastes. And before we get to today's positive, inspiring, uplifting message from the teacher, hearty har har, let's begin at the beginning in the book of Genesis. I want to show you three passages that will help put today's message in context. The first is in Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 and 28. It says, "So God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, 'Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living being that moves on the ground.'" So God creates human beings in God's image to represent God on earth. A big part of what it means to be a human being created in the image of God is to work in God's world. And it's through our work as human beings created in the image of God, the creating, the developing, the building, the organizing, the administrating, the cooking, the cleaning, the ruling over, the shaping of culture as we oversee and continue God's creation project. That's how we fulfill our mission and mandate as human beings. And this mission and mandate is fleshed out, pun intended, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, when God creates the human, God creates the Adam and puts him in a garden, the Garden of Eden, to work it and take care of it. Life in the garden for Adam, and then later on for Eve, included work. Not as punishment, not as a curse, not as a burden, but as a blessing, a calling, a vocation from God. If life in the garden is the ideal of what life with God in God's world is supposed to be like, then that ideal includes God-given, God-ordained, God-blessed work. But then we see in Genesis chapter 3, when Adam and Eve rebel against God and assert their independence by eating from the fruit from the forbidden tree, God pronounces a series of curses on them before exiling them from the garden. They are exiled from the presence of God. And one of the curses has to do with the nature of work outside the garden. So we read in chapter 3, verse 17, to Adam, God said, "Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from all, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground." So here we see not just the fall of humanity in chapter 3, Genesis 3. We also see the fall of work. Work, because of the curse, becomes toil. A wearying burden necessary for survival. I don't know what work was like in the garden before Genesis 3. But I know this, it wasn't toil. Food was everywhere. It grew on trees. But now Adam must fight and struggle to grow food amidst the thorns and the thistles. And God says, it will not be easy. One writer says, from this point forward, it will always be no pain, no grain. So, the teacher in Ecclesiastes, when he talks about life under the sun and how frustrating it is to him, what is he talking about? He's talking about what life is like outside of the garden. Everything he says as someone living in and observing a fallen, broken, imperfect world in which God's image bearers are no longer fulfilling their potential. So no wonder he has so many complaints about the way the world works. Because outside of the garden, apart from God, nothing works the way it's supposed to, including work. And today we're going to see how the teacher has quite a bit to say about the burden of work or toil. But not all of it, we already know, is negative. Because we've seen in weeks past that the teacher names finding satisfaction in your work, finding those moments of satisfaction in your toil under the sun. He says that is a source of fleeting or temporary joy. It doesn't last, but when you experience it, receive it as a gift from God. For example, he says in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 12 and 13, he says, I know there's nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, do good work, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is a gift of God if you can find satisfaction in your toil, because it's in those moments of temporary joy when you are satisfied with the work that you're doing. That's when you catch a glimpse or hear an echo or sniff a whiff of what life in the garden was like, or what life in sync with God could be like. It is a gift from the Lord. Though toil can be a source of temporary joy, we're 4 weeks into Ecclesiastes now. This is the fifth week, so you are not surprised to learn that the teacher's overall evaluation of toil is net negative. He sees it as part of the problem with life under the sun. Here's one of his summary statements in chapter 2, verse 17. He says, so I hated life. I hated it. Why? Because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless vapor. It's a chasing after the wind. He says, my work made me hate life. And he leaves scattered throughout Ecclesiastes a number of reasons for this negative appraisal of work. But you have to read through Ecclesiastes and sort through to find all of these reasons, because Ecclesiastes reads more like a stream of consciousness fever dream than a well-organized logical essay. And another thing, he says, and another thing, and another thing, and another thing. And you're chasing all these other things, and he's making all these different points in all these different directions. But you read it all, and you sort it out, and you can make some sense of his problem with work. So here are three main problems with toil, according to the teacher in Ecclesiastes. First, the problem with toil is that you cannot outwork death. You can't outwork death. We saw last week that death is really the ultimate big villain for the teacher in Ecclesiastes. If the product of his work is a sandcastle, then he sees death as the wave that comes in and washes it all away so that it is meaningless vapor. His opening question in Ecclesiastes has to do with toil. In chapter 1, verse 3, and what can be gained from it? What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? What's the profit? What's the payoff? It's a financial term. What's the bottom line on all the work we do under the sun? And then he answers his question in chapter 2 when he says, after I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I'd toiled to achieve, he says, I see now that nothing was gained under the sun. When it's all said and done, he says, there's no net profit to my life. There's no gain. Because when I die, I lose all of it. I have to leave behind all of it. I have to lose or let go of control of all of it. And so there's no gain. Later on in chapter 5, he says this, verse 15 and 16. He said, everyone comes naked from their mother's womb, and as everyone comes, so they depart. They take nothing from their toil that they can carry in their hands. This, too, is a grievous evil. As everyone comes, so they depart. And what do they gain since they toil for the wind? You cannot outwork death, he says. Second, you cannot not outwork your appetite. Second problem with toil is you can't outwork your appetite. He says in chapter 6, verse 7, he says, everyone's toil is for their mouth, yet the appetite is never satisfied. Literally, on the most basic level, human beings work so that we can eat. But we're always hungry. In fact, the harder you work, the more energy you expend working, the hungrier you are. This is why exercise alone is not enough to lose weight, because exercise makes you want to eat more food. The more food you eat, the more you need to exercise, but the more you exercise, the hungrier you are. It is meaningless vapor. You can't get ahead. You can't outwork your appetite, literally and metaphorically, because we also work so that we can afford to buy and acquire and accumulate those things, those finer things, those luxuries, those nice things in life that we think will satisfy us. But it's never enough. And so he says in chapter 5, verse 10, he says, whoever loves money never has enough of it. And whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. This too is meaningless vapor. J.D. Rockefeller was asked one time, how much money is enough? And his famous answer was, just a little bit more. Because you can't outwork your death and you can't outwork your appetite. And then he also says you can't outwork the competition. Oh, we'd love to believe that we can, but we can't do it, not over the course of a lifetime. You can't outwork the competition. So he says in chapter 4, verse 4, he said, I saw that all toil and achievement, all of it, all the toil, all the achievement, he said, spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless vapor. It's a chasing after the wind. The teacher traces all ambitious achievement back to rivalry, envy, competition. Once we've worked enough to be able to meet our basic needs so that we are taken care of, we have food, shelter, clothing, all those things on the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Why do we keep pushing ourselves? Why do we keep working harder and harder and harder to our own detriment or even to the detriment of those around us? Why do we keep pushing? Well, the teacher says, and you may want to disagree with him, that's fine. But the teacher says it all comes back to this. We want to set ourselves apart from our neighbors. We see how well our neighbors are doing, and we not only want to keep up with them, but we want to beat them. We want to win. We use our toil to demonstrate our significance in life. We use our achievements to demonstrate that we are better or more special than others around us. We've noted before, the teacher does have this obsession, and I don't know what else to call it. It's an obsession. He wants to be the wisest, and he wants to be the wealthiest. He wants to be the best, and he wants to be remembered as such. And yet he knows, as he reflects on his life, he can't outwork the competition. Because there is always going to be somebody else coming. Always. Someone who's bigger, stronger, faster, smarter, younger. And the teacher can tell when he dies. He knows. He's seen it happen before. When he dies, he is quickly going to be replaced by a newer model. And then soon forgotten. You can't outwork the competition. Maybe for a day, maybe for a week, maybe for a year, maybe for a decade, but not over the course of your life. You cannot outwork the competition. You will not always be the best. And it's this futile pursuit, this chasing after the wind, trying to outwork death, outwork our appetite, outwork the competition that leaves us exhausted and in despair. In chapter 2, verse 22, the teacher asks the question, what do people get from all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? What is the real gain, the true gain of all this work and anxiety around it? Here's the answer. He said, all their days their work is grief and pain, even at night. Their minds do not rest. Let those who are taking melatonin at night to go to sleep say amen. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This is meaningless vapor, he says. Toil, especially selfish toil, self-absorbed toil, leaves us physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually exhausted to the point that we can hate life, to the point that we can hate what was supposed to be a gift from God, life. Self-absorbed toil not only leaves us exhausted, but the teacher, he's kind of like the guy on TV. He's like, but wait, there's more. Not only will you be exhausted, but he also says it can leave you isolated and alone. He notices this in chapter 4, verse 8. He says, there was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil. Yet his eyes were not content with his wealth, so he just keeps on working. And he asks the question, for whom am I toiling? And why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless vapor. It's a miserable business, working for yourself. Not being self-employed, but being self-absorbed in your toil. Working for yourself to benefit yourself, to set yourself apart, to make a name for yourself, to show that you yourself are special and better and beyond others. When we work for our selfishness, we find that the self is a brutal taskmaster. In chapter 5, speaking of those who are toiling for the wind, he says in verse 17, since they toil for the wind, all their days they eat in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. They eat, but it's dark and it's miserable. Have you ever known someone who was so poor, the only thing they had was money? That's who the teacher's describing in these verses. Reminds me of Ebenezer Scrooge. Does it sound a lot like Ebenezer Scrooge? Eating in darkness, frustrated, angry, bitter, alone. This is, the teacher says, the futility of self-absorbed toil. It's meaningless vapor. The teacher, of course, is more a namer of problems than he is a namer of solutions. It's one of the things that's so frustrating about reading Ecclesiastes. You've got all these problems, and you can identify with them all, and you see what he's saying and where he's coming from, but then you think, okay, but what's the answer? What's the solution? And there aren't a lot of good solutions in Ecclesiastes. But one thing the teacher does is suggest some coping strategies. These coping strategies do not solve the problem of miserable toil. They don't fix it, but they can help us manage it or at least make the problem a bit more tolerable. And he gives one of these coping strategies. Here's how you manage this. If you feel the heaviness in the room right now because it's all meaningless, here's how you manage it. He says in chapter 4, verse 5 and 6, it's in the form of a proverb. He said, fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. So the first thing he does is disavow any notion that anyone would hear his words about toil and take it as an excuse to not work or to be lazy. Well, if there's no long-term profit or gain to toil, if it's all really meaningless vapor, then why work at all? And the teacher says that is a recipe for ruin. That's foolish. You got to work. But then he also disavows the opposite extreme with a better than proverb. He says it is better to have one handful, better to have one handful with tranquility, literally with rest, better to have one handful with rest than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. It's better to work with one hand and get what you need to get to live and to survive and enjoy life, but it's also good to have some rest along with it, because if you go after it with both hands, that just makes you miserable. One writer suggests that here the teacher sounds like a recovering workaholic who is warning other workaholics of the dead-end path they're on and suggesting a strategy of moderation. You gotta work. You gotta do the work. You can't be lazy. That's foolish. But don't overdo it. Don't work too hard. Build in a rhythm of rest with your work so that you can enjoy your life and so that you can find satisfaction in your toil. Don't go to extremes and work too hard, he says. Rest. One hand with tranquility is better than two hands with misery. He says something similar in chapter 7, only in this passage we're about to read, he's talking about righteousness, a religious word, and wisdom. He says in chapter 7, verses 16 and following, he says, do not be over-righteous, like self-righteous. I'm going to change the world with my righteousness. He said, don't be over-righteous. Neither be over-wise. I think he could add here, and don't be a workaholic. Why destroy yourself? But then he comes back and says, don't be over-wicked, and do not be a fool. He could add, and don't be lazy. Why die before your time? It is good to grasp the one and not let go of the other. And whoever fears God will avoid all extremes. Is that a life verse for our culture right now or what? Avoid all extremes. One of his coping mechanisms, his strategies, is moderation. Avoid extremes. I love the story of the businessman who takes a vacation to a seaside village, fishing village. And one morning, this businessman is standing on a pier watching the fishermen go out and come in. And one fisherman, local fisherman, comes in his little boat, and he has a stringer full of fish. And they're impressive. And the businessman asks him, he says, wow, that's a great catch. How long did it take you to catch those fish? And the fisherman said, it didn't take me long at all. I'm the best fisherman in the village. And the businessman says, well, if you're the best fisherman in the village, why don't you fish longer and catch more fish? Why quit so early? What do you do with the rest of your day? And the fisherman says, well, I sleep in, and then I go fish for a bit in the morning. And then I come in, and I play with my kids, and I spend time with my wife, take a nap in the afternoon. And then in the evening, my wife and I, we stroll to the village, and we sip wine with our friends and play the guitar. He says, my life is full and happy. And the businessman scoffs and says, no. Listen to me. I am a successful CEO of a major corporation. I have a talent for seeing, recognizing business opportunities, and I see one before me. What you need to do is you need to spend more time fishing and catch more fish so that you can buy a bigger boat. And then with your bigger boat, you can eventually make enough money to buy multiple boats. And then with those multiple boats, you could buy an entire fleet and you could have fishermen working on all of your boats and you could move away from this little village and live in the big city and oversee your growing empire. And the fisherman says, wow, how long would that take? And the businessman says, it would take 15 or 20 years. And the fisherman said, and then what? And the businessman says, well, then, when the time is right, you're going to announce an IPO and sell stock in your company to the public. You're going to make millions. You'll be rich. And the fisherman says, and then what? And the businessman says, well, then, you'd be able to retire and move to a little village like this. And you could sleep late and go fishing in the morning and come in and play with your kids or your grandkids and spend time with your wife, and at night you could stroll into the village and sip wine and play guitar. Fisherman said, wait, never mind. And he took his fish and left the businessman behind. The teacher coaches us toward moderation. We moderate toil with rest. That's one of his coping strategies. He gives us another coping strategy in chapter 4, verse 9. He says, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. It's better to work with someone else than to work by yourself, he says. If either one of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. The teacher takes a measure of comfort, a measure of relief from miserable toil in community. And working with others. Even in the garden before the fall, it was not good for Adam to do his work alone. And so God gave Adam a partner to share the load. Work is not always fun. We will not always be able to find daily satisfaction in our toil. But if we have the opportunity to work alongside people that we enjoy working with, that, the teacher says, is a blessing from God, never to be taken for granted. Toil is still toil in this life under the sun. But when you get to toil with other people, it lightens the load. And not only that, it also increases the possibility that we will find satisfaction in our labor. Because instead of laboring for selfish gain, to set ourselves apart, we're using our gifts and talents and energies for the sake of other people. We're working for them as we work with them, and they're working with and for us. And when we're in need, they can help us. And when they're in need, we're helping them. There is some meaning to be found in life under the sun in that kind of communal work ethic. Since I've already mentioned Ebenezer Scrooge, I'll go ahead and mention George Bailey. Merry Christmas early in October. This is the lesson George Bailey learns at the end of It's a Wonderful Life, isn't it? When he thinks that his life is meaningless, when he thinks that he's wasted his life, when he is suicidal because he's never been able to achieve his goals, never made his dreams come true, not able to get ahead, he thinks it's all a waste. And instead, what he learns is it's been a wonderful life because along the way, he has helped so many people. And those people he has helped along the way, they are now there for him at the end to help him when he's in need. George Bailey learns that no man is a failure who has friends. He did not gain everything he wanted out of life, but he was rewarded for his selfless toil for the sake of others. The teacher does not provide ultimate solutions, but his coping mechanisms are definitely on the right track. Fast forward to the New Testament very quickly. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, he says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. There is a way of life, Jesus says, and you can learn this way of life from me. That is not miserable. That is not wearisome. That is not exhausting. There is a way of life, a rhythm of life that we learn from Jesus that can be restful and life-giving. We can have in one hand and enjoy rest and tranquility in the other. And then Luke chapter 9, Jesus says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will save it. And then this line echoes of Ecclesiastes, what good is it for someone to gain the whole world? There's that word, gain. You can gain the whole world under the sun and yet lose or forfeit their very self. Jesus says there is a way of life that is selfishly obsessed with gain, and that way leads to loss. But there is also a way of life that is self-giving and sacrificial. It's cross-shaped, and we learn that way of life from Jesus. And that leads to a kind of gain, call it salvation, that not even death can take away from us. And then finally, there's this word of encouragement from Paul at the very end of 1 Corinthians 15. He says, therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. There is a kind of work that is not in vain. There is a labor that lasts. And Paul says it is the work of the Lord that we do together as a church for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of one another, for the sake of our neighbors, for the sake of the world. And he says that work lasts forever. So let us give ourselves to that work, the work of the Lord, and let us work together in community. And may the joy of the Lord be our reward, both now and forevermore.